Welcome to the episode 6 of Teaching to Meet the Moment from the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. I'm Nicole Luciani-Elliott.
And I'm Mike Hines.
In today's episode, Grading for Equity, we'll be talking about how this current moment in education is leading many teachers to re-examine their grading practices and priorities and search for alternative measures. If you spend any day at a school in America, you'll often hear students asking each other something about grading that's very telling about what they think about grading. What grade did you get? Did you get a good grade? Did you get a bad grade? What'd you get? What'd you get? What'd you get? Rarely, if ever, do students equate grades with how much they've learned. They're not asking each other how much they learned. Let alone, they also are not asking an equally important question, what do they have yet to learn? Instead, they see or have been taught to see by us grades as judgments, a person with the power to make judgment about whether they are good or bad, succeeding or failing. And these judgments we know can impact stress level, a student's self-esteem, and over time, their openness to engage in new learning. The only thing more vulnerable than teaching is learning. And if we want our kids to remain vulnerable and remain engaged in the act of new learning, we have to do some different thinking about grading. Further, grading does not always seem to be tied to learning, if at all. It's really tied to the doing of school rather than learning in school. And kids whose family culture and or their individual personality matches the culture of school essentially start at second or even third base when it comes to grades, because they know how to do school regardless of what they've learned. As educators, almost all of us are sensing that something is wrong with this picture, and working at a distance has put a magnifying glass on a lot of inequities, grading being high on the list of the ones that we know to be true. So our questions today really center around, how do we know what's wrong with grading, and what are we going to do to fix it once we identify those problems? I think this is probably not a new question. Mike, tell us what you know about kind of the history of grading practices.
Yeah, Nicole, I agree with everything you've said, and it's definitely not a new phenomenon or a new conversation. I think teachers have questioned grading practices for a long time. You know, as just one example, as I was researching for this pod, I came across the words of a teacher named Dorothy Dezouche writing in the 1940s in a professional journal called The Clearinghouse. And she had something to say that I think every teacher has thought about at some point. She wrote, "If I were asked to list 10 educational stupidities, the giving of grades would head the list. How often have I heard the protest, but when I give Jim an I don't mean that he's inferior. I just mean that it represents the level of work he does. I'm sure Jim understands what I mean. Like heck he does. Instead of figuring out what letter best describes Jim, I ought to spend my time figuring out ways to help him learn what he needs to learn." So that basic observation that something in our grading system is getting in the way of our students' learning, and by extension, getting in the way of our real values and priorities as teachers, it's led many educators to experiment with new ways to measure student performance and growth, ways that aim to be more accurate, more useful, and more equitable for all. And today's guests are all practitioners who've been involved in this movement about rethinking and reforming grading practices. So we're really excited to have them on. I'll start our introductions, and you'll see our wonderful guest come on. First up is Ward Stern. Ward is a graduate of the University of San Francisco's Teacher Education Program. He's taught English at Tennyson High School in Hayward, California for 6 years, and he's a Stanford Hollyhock 2019 Fellow. He plans to continue teaching for years to come.
We also have Chelsea Hinderly. Chelsea has been a high school language arts teacher in Burien, Washington for 9 years. She grew up in Burien and returned in 2012 to be an educator there. She loves collaborating with her colleagues and helping students learn more about themselves.
Last but not least, we're joined by Jamie Flesher. Jamie is a 10th grade language arts and AVID teacher at Highline High School in Burien, Washington, where she's in her fifth year of teaching. She's a graduate of the University of Washington Secondary Teacher Education Program, and she's a current Hollyhock Fellow. So thank you to all three of you for being here with us. Each one of you is working on how to reshape how grading looks in your own classroom, so we're really curious what started you all down that path. So my first question would be, where do each of you see traditional grading practices as failing us, either failing us as teachers or failing our students? And I'd love to start off with Jamie.
First of all, a lot of what you and Nicole were saying in the introduction really resonated with me a lot. I think that idea of separating the grade from the identity is something that I know I struggled with as a student, and many of our students probably struggle with as well. So I do think that that is a layer in what makes traditional grading difficult. I don't know that I can say across the board, you know, traditional grading is harmful for everyone in all cases, but I do think, you know, in my classroom, it definitely led to an environment of perfectionism and just trying to do the work to the exact specific standard that was laid out in my carefully worded rubrics. Mm-hmm. And, it really took away the safety of taking risks and asking questions and just being in the process and the mess together, which is part of what's fun in an ELA classroom in particular. So I think that is one area where traditional grading has, like, I've experienced the drawbacks of that.
Mm-hmm. Ward, I saw you nodding while Jamie was giving that answer. Do you want to build on that?
Yeah, thank you, and good to see you again, Jamie. If I'm plotting traditional grading on a continuum, I would add to one end schooling or sort of the game of school. I remember my first year teaching freshman English, I had this like Malcolm Gladwell-like discovery where I thought I had sort of cracked the code. And I noticed there were all these predictors as to what a student's semester grade would be. And one of the best predictors was just asking students, like in a survey, how often do you check the teacher's grade book? Mm-hmm. Teachers record, it's now online, the grades, all the assignments and the cumulative grade. And the students I found that checked the grade often were the ones who ended up with a high semester grade, and the ones who didn't end up with low. And I thought this was an amazing epiphany. And so the second year, I thought all I have to do is teach sort of traditionally low performing students how to crack the code, how to play this game of school, how to collect the points and get the points and check your points all the time. So every other week I would get out the Chromebooks and we would check your grade on what our software was, Infinite Campus. And I ended up, of course, with the same grades both years because I was trying to change the person. I was trying to teach them how to play this game of grades. And for a lot of my students, that's not at the forefront. That's not their main reason for coming is playing this game of grades. And so I slowly had to kind of move along the continuum to, I think, grading for equity. And I would also add just learning or education and really trying to make the grade tied to what they learn. And not that I've arrived at the answer, but every year my syllabus does look different and I do tweak or play or tinker with the grading policy. And I'm not Malcolm Gladwell.
What I think that really resonates, the notion that kids sometimes were more invested in teaching them about sort of the grammar of schooling, right? Mm-hmm. Or how to do school correctly. You know, the points for attendance, the points for having a pencil, the point for having your notebook, the point for, you know, being in your desk when the bell rings, right? Those are about things that have probably nothing to do with learning or at least are very like tangential to learning the skills that we want our students to learn and that mm-hmm. their grades should reflect. Chelsea, I wanted to know, what does this look like in your classroom? How are our traditional grading practices maybe coming up short?
Yeah, I think especially as Jamie and I started to sort of have deeper conversations about like what we were rewarding in our classrooms. And I think we kept coming back to this idea, Ward, you kind of talked about it, like of wanting grades to reflect learning, but somehow they weren't. And then we got curious about how much learning is actually happening in our classes. And I think that got me to start questioning, like, when do I do my best learning? And it's when I'm making mistakes and correcting them and fixing them. And traditional grading practices go against all of that, right? Because they quote unquote punish you for making mistakes or not doing it perfect the first time. And so it cultivates this like fear in students of like, if I don't do it right the very first time, then we get a lot of the shutdown where students are like, well, I'm just not going to do it at all, like willfully not engaging in the assignment because they're afraid of not getting it perfect the first time. Or then we get this, you know, obsession with checking the grade book all the time and then like questioning the teacher on like, why am I missing these 3 points on this one assignment, which is still like the grade book shows that they're achieving, but it's still not focusing them on what they're learning. It's focusing them on what they're doing, right? On doing the work rather than learning the lessons. And I think that both of those are harmful to students in a lot of ways, right? Cultivating the, you know, obsessive perfection or like encouraging this sort of shutdown because they're afraid of making mistakes when that's like how we get better at anything. Like no one does anything perfect the first time.
To Chelsea's comment, I think it's really important that she highlighted both ends, right? Because even when our students are being compliant, right? And even when our students are, you know, achieving in a traditional sense, right? It's about what we're rewarding, right? And, you know, I think that some of the most sort of discouraging things that a teacher can hear is, you know, you give an assignment and your students ask, the first question they ask is this for a grade? Right? Because if it's not, right, then we're all going to shut down, right? So you don't want to create that culture where everything has to be tied to a grade.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we've done this to our kids, the people of our profession. It starts, I think, with reward charts in elementary school and the whole carrot and stick of grades. Well, you're not going to get your points if you don't blah, blah, blah. And so then we create this like, well, I don't give a care about your points. And then the others who are like, I need the points. And you're right. I think it's a spectrum of dysfunction. And the learning is the lost question. I'll never forget. I had a student in my AP government class once who did not one time pick up a pencil. Like he got an F all the way through. And then he took the test and he got a 5. And I had to really grapple. Like that was my moment where I'm like, this kid learned everything, but was completely non-compliant. So where does the grade work there? I'm going to not let this kid graduate from high school because he did the learning, right? But he didn't do the doing. I'm wondering for you all, where the notion of equity comes in when you're thinking about grades and grading students. Do you see a connection between grading and issues of equity or issues of kind of responsiveness or non-responsiveness on the school system, on the part of the school system with our kids? What comes up for you when I bring up the question of equity as it relates to grading, Chelsea?
I think that's a really good question. I'm not sure I have like a very well articulated answer, but I know for like one of the things particularly this year that has sort of come to the forefront of my mind is like the need for differentiation in all ways is like greater than ever. And I think that that's probably not new. It just is maybe easier for me to see this year than it was in years past when I was going through like the educational motions. And so I think that along with, you know, like at its core, differentiation is about equity, and you can't take grading or assessment or evaluation out of that. And so I think that I'm trying to figure out how to articulate it. Like not every student is starting at the same place. And so to use the same quote unquote grading practices on all of them feels inherently inequitable because they're not all beginning at the same place. And if they all do the same things, they will end up at, you know, whatever your end goal is that you've set out there. And so to sort of try and apply this blanket approach to all of them, I think now more than ever, we're seeing that just like doesn't work. It doesn't serve massive portions of our student population.
And it ties me back to something you said before, this idea of approaching grading from a lens of curiosity. And it's clear that you and Jamie have a good relationship, that you're able to talk about these things and really reflect deeply. Because if you're not reflecting deeply, differentiation can look like enabling, like hot, in a hot minute. And so to differentiate, you really need to be in tune with the child and in tune with your own biases and your own perceptions, right? Jamie, what do you think of when you think about equity and the notion of grading, and anything resonating for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, what Chelsea's saying about differentiation hits pretty hard. And then, Nicole, I think you're kind of starting to touch on, like, the teacher's role in equity in the classroom when we're the ones who are putting the grade on the report card. So I think that's a thing that I know that Chelsea and I have both reflected on a lot this year, in terms of, like, you know, she mentioned at the top of the podcast, what are we rewarding? You know, if we are the ones who are putting the grade on the report card, that there is a sense of power in that. And that power dynamic of two people in a room together learning and talking about a book together, teacher to student, that mm-hmm. becomes imbalanced once the grade becomes part of the conversation. And so one thing that I have found to be really exciting and equalizing in terms of removing grades from the conversation is trying to make a space where it says, like, you have as much say in this as I do, and instilling the student with the power that has been, you know, we've all worked to take power away from students in some ways.
Mm-hmm. We're going to come back to that, because I want to ask you specifically what you've been doing in your schools to kind of disrupt this. I just want to get Ward's thoughts kind of on the bigger picture of equity and grading, what comes up for you. And then I'm going to circle back and talk about, okay, so what are you doing in your classroom, and what might others want to think about doing as well? Ward, what comes up for you with this question of equity and grading?
I think the terrible irony is that one of the sort of best recommendations in grading for equity is that we don't grade homework. We give lots of homework and lots of practice because we want students to make mistakes and not feel penalized and play that sort of Chuck E. Cheese game of collecting their points and turning it to the gift shop. The thing is, we're doing distance learning now, and it's all homework, right? I mean, that's the terrible irony. And so I can't tell you how many of my students are helping their younger siblings with school over Zoom, who they themselves have had COVID, who have a daycare in their family. And so they have to walk away and help out with their parent or the business. And yet they have to maintain school, and I'm supposed to give a grade to that student. And so I don't know how I can, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald said the measure of first rate intelligence is to hold two opposing ideas and not go crazy. And I have to tell you, just as a practitioner, I'm supposed to give an eighth ref and I'm going crazy, because it just is not equitable in any way to do distance learning and assign a letter grade as I see it. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. And this is the conundrum we're all caught in right now, is our system says X, we know Y. What do we do about that?
I just want to sort of interject here, because we're getting some responses in the chat, and we're getting a really good question that I want to bring up to the group, right? So mm-hmm. Xander Piper asks, when I ask teachers, how much time did you spend in your college courses learning about grading, mm-hmm. right? So teacher prep, or how many PDs do you spend on grading? Teachers frequently say, I don't know, not a lot, never, right? Why do we think that grading is something that is so uncomfortable for teachers to talk about, or that we don't usually talk about? Like, it seems to be sort of a topic that's hidden in plain sight. Mm. And I'm wondering what our panel thinks about that. Why aren't we maybe as comfortable talking about grading as we should be? Why don't we cover it in schools of education the way we should? Ward, go ahead.
I'll push back against Xander a little bit. My program is very social justice oriented, and we read Alfred Crowan and Manzano and talked about grading for equity. And at my school, Tennyson High School, last year it was fortuitous, we did a grading for equity workshop because the teacher was really passionate about the subject, and in some ways it was a success because she introduced the language and ideas around grading for equity. So I think some teachers were maybe not converted, but willing to sort of play with their homework policy or their late work policy. But so where I'll push back is I think we're willing to quote unquote start the conversation, but my beef or frustration with districts, and particularly mine, is that it never moves beyond the teacher conversation. It never gets institutionalized into a policy level. And the moment, and we can get into sort of what I've done in terms of advocacy, the moment I had so many support and allies helping to start the conversation, I could get a department meeting, a PD to talk about grading for equity. But the moment it went to the policy level, where you had the teacher union and the district level leadership, there was incredible pushback and resistance. And I think that's where the elephant in the room kind of really reared its head. So yes and no, I guess, to Zena.
What exactly have you been doing sort of on the ground, working to try and change these practices? And then we'll get Jamie in too. And then I do want to talk about this this issue of pushback or this issue of resistance. But first, let's get an idea of what's going on the ground and how you guys are trying to change grading practices. Chelsea, you could start.
We've not had the fabulous experience that, well, semi-fabulous experience that Ward is talking about. And I think to just briefly answer your question, Mike, I think that grading is, it's somehow become highly personal. I think maybe because it often represents what we as the teacher or the person in power values. And so when you start to sort of push on that, like when administrators push on that and say, like, here are the things we should be valuing, people take that very, can take that very personally. And they're like, no, these are the things I value. And I show that through my grading policies. And so you making me question that is going to actually make me look at like my entire philosophy of who I am as a teacher. And that's like, really huge. And I know like Jamie and I for sure have experienced a lot of that like personal turmoil that comes along with like rethinking your grading practices, because you do have to look at your values first, and you have to examine how you're looking at students and how you want them to feel in your classroom. And that can be like a really vulnerable experience. So I don't know, Jamie, if you want to just sort of outline what we started to do in this experiment that we're doing.
So Jamie and Chelsea work together at Highline High School. You're in the same department, in the same building, and you all are in the very beginnings of this conversation where it's not going much further than your classroom right now. So really the folks who want to tune into what you all are saying are the folks who are like, I know something's wrong. I have to do something. I don't know what to do. Right. And that's really where we're going to listen to you all and learn from you. It feels like Ward might be one step beyond that, where his department, or at least some of his colleagues, some of his crew at Tennyson are on board, but now are kind of stuck at, well, now I have to advocate because we're plateaued. And that'll be a different level of the conversation. There's other folks who do this work, and I'll just name the Mastery Collaborative as one of them in New York City, who have been doing and thinking about this work for a few years. There's some schools in Chicago Public Schools that are now fully mastery grading. We didn't ask those folks to be on because we feel like most folks are in either this personal and or site level. Very few are way into the conversation right now. So I just wanted to orient the listener to our intentions here in bringing the three of you on. And also to note for any veteran teachers among us here today, I'm having a striking echo in my ear as Chelsea talks about grading, because this is a conversation we were having about classroom management about 10 years ago. There was no classroom management and teacher prep. Classroom management was so personal. People got very defensive the second somebody brought it up. And it's still a little bit that way, but it's far less so. And it feels like grading is really the tipping point right now, where classroom management was 10 or 15 years ago. It's a fascinating thing to be in this profession a long time. So Jamie, with all of that said, it's a context laid. Tell us, what are you and Chelsea doing as like, we need to do something. So what are you doing?
Well, this year we are really working on building off of some of the work that our colleagues have been working on for some time. So we kind of started the year with this premise of like, what if we go gradeless? one of our colleagues, Allie Morgan, that is also a Hollyhock fellow, had experimented with this idea in some of her upper level classes last year and gave us a good place to start and some resources for how to begin a gradeless classroom. And so we're trying to implement that to some level. And for us, what that means is really spending a lot of time talking about learning and trying to pull that conversation of the grade out of the conversation. And it is hard. We struggle with this. Like, Chelsea and I meet 3 times a week, and I think we struggle with it 2 times a week. It is so easy, even as people who are here saying, like, we believe in this practice of going gradeless, we want to talk about learning instead. It is so hard to say, like, you need to do this because your grades are bad. Like, that is so hard. So I think, as you said, we're early on in the process. So for us, it's a lot of conversations with students. We're implementing like a pretty like stringent conference schedule. We try to meet with students on an individual basis pretty regularly so that we can talk to them in depth about their writing with a partner. And that's been really cool. We're trying to, I feel like that for us replaces the traditional, like, I'm going to update my grade book every other week. Like, that for us is like, hey, we're checking in. We're talking about your writing today. What's going well? What's not?
Do they keep a journal or anything to kind of track their thoughts or the feedback, or is there anything there that they do?
Yeah, we've been trying to use the idea of a portfolio this year. We're using Padlet, so like they'll make a post, and hopefully before their conference, they're making a post of like, here's the piece of work that I want to talk about, and here's what I like about it, here's what I'm struggling with in terms of it, and then we had hoped that maybe they'd go do some reflection after the conference, but Chelsea and I were just talking before we came on this podcast about like, our system has had to evolve in response to how well our students are uptaking certain parts of it. And right now the post-work isn't something that we've been able to really nail down as much. But Chelsea, I saw you unmute there for a second. Did you want to add anything?
Well, I was just thinking about how the idea of teacher pride kind of plays into this, because we are so in the fledgling stages of this, and we've run into so many situations where we've like cultivated a way to approach conferences or portfolios, and then we roll it out with students, and then we realize like, oh, this is not working for them. And maybe it's because of the distance learning model, or maybe it's just because like the amount of untraining that we need to do in their brains to stop thinking about grades and start thinking about learning means that they're just not ready for, you know, what we're trying to offer them. And so the number of times we've had to sit down and be like, are we holding on to this too tightly just because we worked really hard on it? And we have to sort of like reevaluate. And I think that that's, for me, one of the biggest things that I've done this year, because in the past I've been very like, all right, I sat down in September, I created this sort of grading policy this year, and I'm going to move forward with it. And even if, you know, November or March or May hits and I realize it's not really working for me or my students, like I keep pushing through because it's what I set out to do in September. And this year we've really like sort of allowed ourselves to, or humbled ourselves to, come to the students and say, this is not working for us, it's not working for you, so we're going to try something different.
Yeah.
And even though that shift might be hard of like, we were asking you to do this and now we're not, I think that ultimately it's a big part of the learning piece for us. And if that's what we're trying to teach our students to do, be willing to like make mistakes and adjust, we have to be modeling that for them. And we've certainly been doing the mistake modeling for them.
Which is great. I want to highlight 2 things. One that each of you said, first of all, Chelsea, this notion that you're walking the walk of vulnerable learning, right? And teachers are very fearful to do that because we like control. We like predictability. We like to order, right? So that use of the word humility, I think, is so beautiful. And especially if you're articulating, you guys, this is what I want you to be doing. So we're modeling for you that making mistakes is part of life, right? And iterating is the word of 2020, 2021. The other thing, Jamie, you know, when I coach teachers, I know your coach, and she's one of the most beautiful humans in the world. I also am a Hollyhock history coach, and whenever anybody uses the word hope, I like to remind them that Anderson Cooper says hope is not a plan. So if you ever find yourself hoping that students will do something, you have to back up and say, what's my plan? And so now you've learned kind of that the hard way, right? And it's something that we all have to learn for sure. I want to go to Ward next to help us think about this next level. Ward, take us to the next level. So you've grappled, you've learned, you've struggled, you've fallen, you've iterated, you've gotten back up. You've got colleagues who are all on board with you. What's next? Where are you in this process?
Sure. I'll say that I was sort of a reluctant activist. Grading and grades is not something that I am terribly interested in. My sort of jam is curriculum and community building. And then distance learning started, and not all distance learning models are the same. So there were some districts, like the neighboring one to us, Oakland, that implemented a different grading policy. They're calling it holistic grading. So they're going to try to stop failing students over distance learning and provide all kinds of supports. Unfortunately, my district kind of did business as usual, kept the same normal, and it was a sort of a very predictable person-made result that we saw a huge surge in Fs and Ds. So I wanted to, you know, use this crisis, and so working with some folks, it was pretty easy to quote unquote have that conversation around grading for equity and changing our policy. So for example, that looked like working with one of the vice principals at my school to look at summer school, because summer school in California was the first time that we did distance learning and grades. And so it became this great case study to see what happened. And sure enough, we had double the number of Fs over summer school. So we're wondering what trends would continue. So we were able to bring that to staff at my school and then within department meetings and have conversations about how we can change our practices. I was surprised when it sort of went to the leadership level of making decisions around policy, how much pushback and resistance there was. And there was a sort of a question of my motives and intelligence, and I was very surprised, right? Because I'm sort of not used to that. So the moment I was able to sort of have lots of conversations around this, we were able to do sort of our Hollyhock team did this wonderful conversation similar to this one that we're having now for all of our staff. But then bringing it to the policy level and getting my superintendent and union to sort of vote on it, proved incredibly difficult. And it can be done. I mean, San Diego just did it. So this is, you know, I guess I'm also reimagining what success and failure looks like as a sort of advocate role.
Mm-hmm. I think that, Ward, you've given us a segue into some of the questions that we've got in the chat, which are around some of the pushback or some of the arguments that people use sort of against changing, right, traditional grading, or some of the concerns, right, that teachers might have themselves, right? They want to change their traditional grading structures, but there's a lot of concern around things like, what does this do to students' transcripts, right, when they go to apply for colleges or go to the next grade or try to move on, right? How do you keep students motivated in a classroom that doesn't have traditional grades, right? So I saw you guys nodding as those things have come up. How do you address questions like that that are natural for teachers to have with something that's so new and so unfamiliar?
You know, I really admire Chelsea and Jamie for having, I mean, that's sort of a best principle whenever you're going to revise a policy to have an ally and someone to work with. And so that, to me, the danger risk as a practitioner, as a teacher, isn't that I'm sort of using traditional grading practices. It's that my grading policy stays the same and that I'm not willing to kind of reflect on it. And that year after year, I think my grading policy should look different in the syllabus. And so this year, you know, it was sort of a what the heck moment. I can experiment all I want with distance learning. I'm only grading the summative assessment. And so I'll say for the sort of traditional low performing students, the ones that's very easy to predict what their semester grade is, grades were never motivating to begin with. And it was silly of me to think that it was, right? I was trying to teach them how to play this game. Mm-hmm. And this was the first year, and the students who are really motivated by grades are often tracked into high programs, college preparatory programs. And incidentally, I should add, they're the ones who cheat the most because they mm-hmm. the points mm-hmm. and they game the system. And I'm trying to teach other folks how to game the system rather than actually, instead of changing, you know, the system, trying to change the person. So like this year, I only graded the summative assessment. And there were some successes. I certainly had the sort of high track grade grubbers who were asking the subtext question of how can I improve my grade? But they weren't saying, is there extra credit? Can I do something else different? They were saying, because they only knew I used this rubric and these summative assessments, how can I, in my personal narrative, deploy a metaphor better? What can I leave my reader with? And because we just did the summative assessment, all of my students did it multiple times for many of them. And it's the first time I can actually say that the students understood the grade they had. The grade book mm-hmm. wasn't opaque or confusing. They knew how it was calculated. And so when they reflected my traditionally, quote unquote, low performing students, they didn't say things like, well, I got a C in this class because I'm not a good reader, writer, or I don't like English, or Mr. Stern doesn't like me. They said things like, I revised my personal narrative a second time, but I'm still struggling with the theme. I don't quite understand theme yet. Mm. And so that grade actually became a reflection of this particular discipline of personal narrative writing. So that was a win. Mm-hmm. And they were interested in sharing their story. And that was what was motivating. All my students want to learn, period. Do they all want points? No, not all of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ward, just a quick follow-up question before Mike brings it to Jamie and Chelsea. Debbie in the chat has noted this idea of having more non-graded, low-stakes assignments with reflection and feedback and things like that to gear towards something that actually is graded. Is that what you're saying?
Before I embarked on the Nicole and Debbie, the only grading the summative assessment, I mean, my sort of Bible was a book called Pointless, An English Teacher's Guide for More Meaningful Grading by Sarah Zerwin, who was a Denver teacher who did this, who moved to a pointless system. And so I gave tons of feedback, and you just had to kind of play with the grade book, often putting in a zero, but still tracking where the students were with their work and their progress. And they had multiple times where they could revise their summative assessment.
Chelsea, Jamie, we're still sort of revolving around this question of teacher concerns, right? And, you know, stepping into this sort of scary new place of trying to decenter the grade, right, from the conversation. So what have you guys found as the challenges? Is it student motivation? Is it, you know, students being too sort of invested in the old system or knowing how to play that game, or just the unfamiliarity? What do you think are the challenges? Jamie, we'll start with you.
Yes, they're all challenges. And I think, gosh, you know, Nicole mentioned Chelsea and I are still in a fledgling stage here. And so to some extent, this is, especially around questions of student motivation. For me, I know that's something that I'm wrestling with a lot right now, but as Ward was saying, for a lot of our students, grades never were motivating. And so how do we tap into the thing that is motivating for them? And like Ward was saying, I think approaching them with content that they find interesting and that they have a choice with what to engage with is a much better way to like say, hey, come over here with us.
Right. I mean, that connects right back to our point about grading and equity, right? Because what I hear you saying is that not being focused on the grade and instead being focused on having content that really connects with students, that's culturally responsive, right? That's culturally sustaining. That's equity-based work. So that's really interesting. Chelsea, do you want to add to it?
Yeah, I think so. We definitely still very much operate within a larger system that forces us to update a grade book every 2 weeks. We have to give them a letter grade of some kind at the end of the quarter, at the end of the year. And so in an effort to kind of bridge that gap, we have created sort of like other tools to help students track their learning. And so rather than, you know, because we're not in a place where we're able to avoid the grade altogether, what we've really tried to do is create multiple different paths to that grade. And we really, like, that's what we center our conversations with our students around, is like how to get them as an individual to whatever that endpoint is. And so we have, you know, their portfolios is really what we're helping them build throughout the year. And they get choice in what ultimately goes into and onto that portfolio. And so for some of them, they might choose whatever the summative for the unit is. And some of them might choose some of the practice assignments that we did prior to the summative. And so it relieves a bit of the pressure of like, I need to do all of the assignments in order to pass. And also allows students, particularly in this setting, who like are kind of engaging in class and then not engaging in class and then re-engaging in class, it still keeps the path to success, I think, open to them, because it's allowed for this flexibility. Like the path to whatever the grade is that we have to ultimately give you is going to be determined by you along the way. And so I think that that's how we're sort of trying to mediate this, like, we have to have a grade book, we have to give you a grade, but we want to focus you on the learning. So we're going to try and figure out all these different ways that you can have power and control over how you get to whatever that grade is.
Chelsea, I think that's really powerful. One, because it's centering student choice, right? Which we know we should be doing in our classrooms anyway, right? And it's giving some of that power, like Jamie said, back to the students. But second, it's also really interesting because you talked about creating these different pathways for students to reach the same endpoint. And I would assume that that does a lot to sort of counteract what we talked about at the beginning in terms of students coming in, maybe failing the first few assignments or not doing as well as they might have liked on the first few assignments, and then just completely shutting down, right? If you have multiple pathways that are open, right, you don't have to shut down, and you're more free to make mistakes and come back, which is what we want our students to do. So I think maybe as a last question, because I know we're starting to run short on time, I'd really love us all to think about how this looks in relationship to communities and in relationship to parents. So I'm really curious to hear from each of you what the reaction from not only your students, not only your colleagues, but also from parents, right? And from community members, because we know that they have grown up in, we've all grown up in a system of traditional grades. So is it hard for parents to make that transition? I could imagine some very interesting parent-teacher conversations. So let's have Ward start us off with that, and then we'll do Jamie and Chelsea.
Well, I'll say, as I slowly sort of moved away from compliance and playing the game of school to more grading for equity and learning, that every time I have to sort of reiterate and sort of re-educate what I'm trying to do with this policy with my students, they're very confused. Like, how much is this worth again? No, it's not worth points. This is how we're going to do it. And so sort of moving away from the compliance, but I guess the way I would answer your question, when I meet with parents, whether it's calling home or I have to do an SST where I'm with all the teachers and trying to give a student specialized support, I've never had clearer things to say. Usually in the first few years, I was like, he or she's not really participating. They're not really doing their work. They're not paying attention. That's so vague and nebulous as to be meaningless. And it's not helpful to the student or parent. And now I can say, hey, they were telling this personal narrative, their moth, and they're still really stuck with how to end their story. And we've looked at a few different examples and they haven't really decided which way they want to go with it yet. And so the feedback is so much more clear when it's tied to just the summative assessment or sort of the main learning points. So it's been in some ways a sort of blessing in disguise for me and hopefully a little clearer for the students and parents.
So it's allowing you to be more clear in your feedback. That's amazing. Jamie?
Yeah, I think in our district, Chelsea, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking that our I think that most of our students receive standards-based report cards for a large portion of their elementary school experience, at least. So standards-based learning and assessment isn't necessarily something that is new to our students' parents. So luckily, they have some language to talk about standards-based assessments, which is something that's really important as we are talking about, like, going gradeless. We're not necessarily going completely gradeless, but we are talking about, like, well, where is the student, like, showing mastery of this particular standard, and what does that look like? And so I think in many cases, some of our parents are really used to having those conversations. But I will say, you know, sometimes it is hard, and sometimes we do have to, like, take an extra step to explain things. And I think in committing to doing the work, one of the hardest things for me to commit to is, like, I guess I'm going to be talking about my grading policy also. Because it does require a lot of conversations with parents and with students. And it's so, you know, some days you have those days where you're like, man, I wish I could just tell you to turn in this paper. But you have to take the moment to buy into that and lean into that energy and say, like, nope, we're going to direct this back to your learning. And that ultimately is the more energizing thing. So.
And Chelsea, we'll give you the last word.
Oh,
no
my.
Pressure. No pressure.
Yeah, right? I will say we agonized over a well-crafted, quote-unquote, letter that we sent to all of our families, going, like, kind of acknowledging, like, we know that this is not what you're used to. Like, here's what the gradebook represents to us, and here's what we're hoping to do with your student. And that maybe helped. I definitely still have fielded a hefty number of, mostly after report cards come home, where they're like, wait a second, what is this? What does this mean? And so we've had a couple of those conversations, but for the most part, I think, yeah, it's been like trickle down. Training our students to talk about their learning, I'm hoping helps them field the questions from their parents more confidently, and then therefore it doesn't ever need to reach us because they've already been able to explain it to them. So we definitely put like a lot of, we pour a lot of energy into helping restructure our students' understanding of what we're trying to do together in our class. And they don't always pick it up as quickly and easily as we would like them to, but that's what we've committed to this year. So I'll have that conversation as many times as they need to have it.
That's an awesome place to stop. I think that, you know, this is such a huge shift that we've been talking about, right? And it's a conversation that's, you know, uncomfortable. It's a conversation that sort of undermines or can potentially undermine our sense of autonomy as teachers, and our sort of individual little idiosyncrasies that we've cultivated over the years, right? It makes us question our professional expertise and our professional knowledge, right? But each one of you is really engaging with this in a really deep way that I think a lot of other teachers can learn from. So thank you guys all for being so vulnerable, so honest, and for coming to join us today.
Agreed. I'd like to just piggyback and offer, when we think about the takeaways for today, for me, I think some of my takeaways include getting curious, getting super reflective, thinking about, am I willing to do what's right, even though it's hard? Like, these are, I need to enter into this in a really informed and powerful way, with will and skill, knowing that I'm going to stumble, right? And that's what I'm taking away, is that if I'm going to ask my students to be vulnerable, I have to be vulnerable too. And walking into this is really what a more profound way I can serve with love than walking vulnerably into this conversation. Because we do, as Jamie said, have so much power. Think about that. We have the power to change the trajectory of our students' lives if we don't handle this grading with great care. That's the biggest thing I'm taking away. Also, I think one thing I'm taking away is this notion of how much better it is when we have colleagues to talk to and to do it with. And you all have paved that road for us to start having these hard conversations when maybe we wouldn't have been as brave enough to do before. So thank you all so much for being here.
So that brings us to the end of this episode of Teaching to Meet the Moment. We'd like to thank our audience. We'd like to thank Javier and Christine for doing all the behind the scenes work. We'd like to thank our wonderful captioner. And we will see you guys back here next week for episode 7, which we're titling Leveraging Student Assets. So guys, thanks, and we'll see you next week.